Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush. We have another Casey edition. Casey, who got the iTunes review that I told you about.
Oh, I heard about that.
Yeah, I went through the iTunes reviews.
Very generous, whoever wrote
that. Someone said, you should only have Casey on, and he should just be your permanent co-host and always just talk movies with Casey.
That was actually my secret account that posted that. No, not really.
Was that you?
No. Checks in the mail, whoever that was.
So Casey and I are continuing our Kenneth Lonergan tribute. It'll be a short one because there are only three movies.
He's got to make more movies.
And, Casey, we are continuing on with a movie called Margaret that I think I said this last time. I have no idea how this movie got by me. I didn't even know it existed. So maybe it was because of all the history of the lawsuits and it not getting like a decent release and marketing, but I didn't even know it was out there.
Yeah, it had a super quiet release and a super kind of protracted journey, you know, from being shot in like 2005 to coming out all the way in 2011 in a very, very limited, almost sort of like contractual obligation vanity release, you know, like New York and LA only for a couple of weeks. And then, you know, and that was not even Lonergan's preferred cut. It was kind of the shorter version. So we're very, very lucky that we even got the DVD version of the extended cut, I think.
Yeah. So let's go over that and level set real quick. This movie, the Kenneth Lonergan cut, as I guess we can just call it, is 3 hours and 6 minutes of heavy drama. It's unusual for a movie like this to be this long. And how long was the theatrical?
So even the theatrical was pretty long. It was still 2.5 hours. So we're only talking about a difference of like 36 minutes, which is a lot, but you know, not as much as you might've thought.
Yeah. And I think I saw online somewhere where Martin Scorsese and Thelma, is it Schoonmaker or Schoonmaker?
I hear it both ways. I usually say Schoonmaker.
Schoonmaker. Yeah. Who knows? I mean, I took German, so I want to say Schoonmaker.
I think I'm trying to remember how she says it. I think she says Schoonmaker, but I could be wrong.
Yeah. Well, legendary editor, you know, one of the all-time greats. And I saw that they helped him get it down to that theatrical cut. Is that what you saw too?
I don't think it was the theatrical cut. What happened was there was a producer on the film who was, I think, very enthusiastic early on, but then began to kind of insert himself more and more into the kind of editing process and being in the editing room. And he was kind of driving Lonergan crazy with notes and just kind of interfering with the process. And, you know, giving his 2 cents where Lonergan thought this is not really your place. Mm-hmm. And so, that relationship became more and more strained. And eventually Scorsese, who I think was already maybe a producer on the film, he had some level of involvement as he did also with, You Can Count on Me. Right. I think just as an executive producer on that one,
which is basically champion of the film.
Yeah. So Scorsese had already seen Lonergan's kind of like, at that time, favored version of the film, which was probably in the 3 hour-ish range, and said it was a masterpiece. But Lonergan, while he had Final Cut in his contract, he did not have the right to have it be longer than, I think, about 2.5 hours. So even though he had full creative control, he was still obligated to get it down to that length, and he just couldn't do it, or he felt like he couldn't do it anyway. And so Scorsese said, let me get involved here. Let me see if I can kind of whittle some of this down a little bit and we can make something that everybody's happy with. And, you know, Scorsese did his cut with Thelma and Lonergan liked it and everything. But then the producer basically just killed it like out of spite at that point. And spiked it and just said, no, we're going to release this other version that basically nobody really wants, you know, kind of stick it to Mark, to Lonergan. And
stick it to the great artists.
Yeah. And at some point in there also, Dylan Tishner got involved. He's Paul Thomas Anderson's editor. I think he was hired maybe by the producer to kind of do his own cut without Larnigan kind of having any say in it. And that version never saw the light of day either. So the version that did come out in theaters, the 2.5 hour one, Larnigan did have some involvement with, but it was basically like he did it under duress and he doesn't really stand by it necessarily.
Right. Well, so here's what I have to say about the length. It is a movie that is richly rewarding at this length. I could also see, and this is probably a credit to just the great acting and the great directing and the fact that it's a great movie. I could also see a 2 hour and 20 minute version being great. And dude, I could see a 1 hour and 45 minute version of this movie being great.
Yeah, I agree.
The way he has it laid out, there's so much in it. Like the first 1 hour and 15 minutes is almost preamble.
Right.
To, I guess, what quote unquote the real story is.
Yeah.
Which is this young woman who, and if you know, this is obviously going to be spoiled if you're listening and haven't seen it, but this young woman who has a part in a tragic accident wherein a Manhattan city bus runs over Allison Janney and kills her, and she dies in Anna Paquin's, in Lisa's arms. And she is partially to blame because she was distracting the bus driver. So that is sort of the central story. But it's a movie about so much more than that. I mean, it's, you could have made a movie about a girl losing her virginity.
Right.
They make movies
like
about
a coming of age kind of thing. Yeah.
They make movies about girls who get pregnant by their teachers and have abortions.
Yep.
And all these things happen in this movie. These big things. It's crazy.
It's the full kitchen sink, right? It's like, it's the opposite of minimalism. It's like maximalism. It's sort of like you take, even though he has this story that could be kind of the central focus of the film, and it could almost be like a legal procedural kind of thing. Like, are we going to get this guy? Are we going to win the settlement? All that.
That's the 1 hour and 45 minute version.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but I, you know, I feel like to do that, like there are many films within this film. And I think that is entirely the point that Lonergan is making, is that basically, you know, so there's a moment where Emily, who is Monica, the deceased woman, her friend, where she confronts Lisa and basically says, like, this is not your life. This is not your story. You're making it about you because you're young and you're naive and you're inexperienced. But this was my friend that I've known since I was 19 years old. You know, all my life I've known this person. She meant so much to me. And for you to kind of come in at the 11th hour and make it all about you, essentially, is this kind of monstrous thing to do in a way. And she's, Lisa is so like taken back by this, like, I'm just trying to help, you know, but she doesn't have that broader awareness. And what the film as a whole, like as a film, what it's doing is basically saying that, you know, we all think that we're the star of our own movie, and we don't necessarily expand that to realize that we're just like a background player in most people's lives. And, and also that it's part of just being human that we kind of create these narratives, we create these stories to kind of contain the overwhelming amount of things in the world, you know, just the brute reality of like a city like New York, where there's millions and millions and millions of stories. Everybody has their own thing, and it's all colliding and it's all overlapping at the same time. And so in a way it even goes against the idea of like narrative film, because narrative film, the idea is that like you winnow that down, you zero in on just a handful of characters and you kind of tell that one story. But he's trying to tell, or at least suggest, that on the periphery, there's like a million other stories, and this movie could be about any one of them for the point that it's kind of making. In a way, it just happens that they zero in on Lisa, but the broader kind of philosophical point that he's making, you know, you could make a story about any of these people and have it kind of be similarly compelling, I think.
Yeah. And he does that in some very interesting ways. One of the ways he does it is, and there are a couple of scenes where that stand out to me, where he allows the audio track almost in an Altman-esque way.
Yes.
From other conversations to bleed in. Notably the scene where they're in the diner together, she and her kind of best friend who loves her.
Yeah.
And she very cruelly sort of, and I don't even think intentionally, toys with, she's just a very confused young adolescent woman.
Yeah.
a girl. Yeah. And as they're zooming in very slowly on their diner table, you're really listening to a conversation with these two elderly women next to them, but also a little bit of this other table bleeds in, and then they finally get to their conversation. So he does it there, and then he does it in that great shot outside the apartment building when he's panning from outside, the tracking shot by the different windows, and you hear the different conversations at the different windows of the different apartments until you finally land on, I keep wanting to call her Sookie because I was a True Blood person. Lisa and her mom sort of just picks it up in mid conversation. And,
right.
And that stuff really makes it clear that this is a movie about this girl and her full life, but also a movie about New York.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, it's a cliche to say like the city's another character, but it is really true in this case. And you know, there are definitely those two scenes that where it jumps out the most, but anytime there's like an establishing shot or an exterior, mm-hmm. there's always like audio bleeding over from people's conversations on the street. Usually people we don't even see, but just to kind of, convey the idea, like reinforce the idea that life is always going on beyond these stories. And even though this might be considered like high drama to watch this, like realize that the world is just going indifferently at its own pace all around it. And this thing that kind of stops the world for Lisa, the rest of the world just keeps moving.
Yeah. Did you happen to read, I'm sure you probably did, the great Atlantic article and interview with Lonergan?
Yes. Yeah. That's terrific.
Yeah. Really great read. And he pointed out a couple of things, which really kind of drive that home too, was he was always fascinated with the idea of what else is going on aside from the central plot of a movie in these people's lives, and why have we never seen that?
Right.
And I think the reason why is it's not for everyone. This is a borderline experimental film in a lot of ways because of that.
It really is. It's like anti-narrative in a way.
It really is. And the other thing too that he did, which was a very sneaky sort of camera trick, was he said he wanted to have a lot of shots where Lisa wasn't even the focus of the shot, even though she was in the shot. And he said there are plenty where she is, but he said he tried to have a lot of shots of the city where she just sort of passes through, and it's almost like a documentary at times.
Oh, for sure. And you can tell like a lot of those street shots, they're just on a long lens, like several blocks away. They're not blocking off the the streets for filming or anything. I think those are real New Yorkers in a lot of those shots. And it does have like a documentary feel where, Lisa is allowed to just get lost among like the anonymous crowd, you know, and the camera starts to pick up these other faces. And because of the way the movie's been working, it kind of invites you to think like, I wonder what that person's story is. I wonder what their day's like. I wonder what they're worried about or thinking about or going through, you know?
Yeah. There's just the reality and the realness of that Lonergan. I mean, he does it in all those films. It's just astounding. Like that scene early on where she's on the sidewalk and her boyfriend or her friend, I can't remember.
Tries to ask
from
her
Short Term 12, he's great. Yeah, where he asks her out on a date.
Yeah.
It is so like gut wrenching because we've all been there as adolescents to try and figure out that roadmap in front of you that you've never navigated before of asking a girl out on a date. And especially if it's someone that's your friend that you want to like take it to that next relationship level. And they just play it so real. It's really, really great.
Yeah, that's an incredibly relatable part of the story for me. Absolutely. I had that experience numerous times where it was like, it was always like the friend that, you know, the feelings develop for over time more than like, you know, just approaching someone out of the blue and asking them out. That wasn't really a thing. So,
same here.
Yeah. And then the strain that would put on those relationships, you know, whatever the outcome was, there's always like some awkwardness involved if it's not returned, you know, if it's not mutual. So, that's a very, very relatable part of the movie. Even, you know, I love that, the movie just gives you these like little small moments that give you a window into these other lives, even though they're periphery characters. But there's like the scene where she's already called up Kieran Culkin about losing her virginity. Then her friend calls her up, and there's even a shot of him like in his bed with like the Pavement and Interpol posters on the wall. Uh-huh. And it's like, you know, it's a Friday night probably. And like, he's in bed and he's thinking like, should I call her? Should I not call her? And I wonder what she's up to. that's all going through his head. He's just like fixated on this girl. And then he calls her up and he's trying to make conversation and it's not leading anywhere. And she finally just says,
so brutal.
I'm sorry. You know, I don't really feel like talking right now. He's like, oh, okay. Okay. And then he just, you know, hangs up the phone and like starts crying immediately. It's very, very, you know, we don't see him that much through the film, but I love that we have that kind of little private moment just to kind of, I don't know, give us a little bit of richness and detail to these kind of secondary characters.
Yeah, and that's after the party where she makes out with Kieran Culkin and then immediately drunkenly in the hallway tells her friend that she loves him really and kisses him.
Yeah.
And this, oh, poor Darren, he's just like on this roller coaster of young emotion, man. I felt so bad for him. And she's not being cruel, I don't think. I think she's just a confused kid.
Yeah, I think the idea is that like Lisa is, she's more powerful or she has more of an effect on people than she even realizes, right?
Absolutely.
And she hasn't yet learned that necessarily, that what seems to her like a small thing might be a big thing to somebody else. And she so she doesn't have that like empathetic, more developed adult perspective on the world, because she's still like an adolescent and
they're all narcissists.
Yeah. Then this movie is like her journey to some broader awareness. But even at the end of the film, like she's still got a lot of territory to cover before she really gets there. But she does expand that awareness in some ways. And in other ways, she still has a lot more to learn.
Yeah. Since you brought up Kieran Culkin, I adore Kieran Culkin.
Yeah.
I'm a huge, huge fan of his. Igby Goes Down is one of my all-time favorite movies. And he just has a fucking coolness about him that, like, I could never achieve, even as a kid.
Effortless.
And this character is kind of Igby-esque. And I thought the virginity losing scene was, he was being a good guy, you know? He was trying to be very caring. And he was charged with a very big, important thing in her life. He agreed to do it. And he was being very caring and very loving, I think. I kept waiting for that scene to go bad.
Right.
I mean, and it went bad in that he, you know, didn't wear a condom. But I was waiting for it to go bad with him being too aggressive or being a jerk. And the whole time he was really kind of being a good guy and trying to guide her through this thing, I felt like.
I think the movie kind of sets up the expectation that he's going to be more a jerk about it than than he is. And he actually ends up to be a pretty decent person and to not have any kind of particularly impure intentions about the thing, you know? She picks him, you know, she jokes about this with him, like, or he asked her, to what do I owe this honor that you're, you know, giving me? And she's like, oh, it's because of my really profound deep feelings for you, sarcastically. So she's just basically saying, you seem cool and I want to get it over with, and you know, neither one of us is gonna like mistake this for something more than what it is. So this seems like an ideal thing because I trust you and we already know each other a little bit, so let's just do this. But by the end of it, he kind of says, or she says to him, something about, you know, you must not feel anything for me. And he's like, well, I think I've just proved that I at least have some level of feelings for you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that scene later on too, in the acting class when the play isn't going well and they're all getting real. And the teacher, it's such a very drama class thing to do, basically sits down and has this sort of group therapy where they all admit these things to one another and then hug it out one at a time.
Right.
And they get over to his character. I mean, it's basically Igby. I'm just going to call him Igby.
Yeah, sure.
And he's like, man, I play in the band and on these songs for this play. And I just kind of want to come here and do that and go smoke a joint on the roof.
Yeah,
and I don't want to hug anyone. But he's not being an asshole. He's still so affable. And the teacher is like, well, you want to hug me? And he's like, hello. Come here.
Yeah.
It's such a great moment. So real.
Yeah. He's I mean, he only has like a handful of scenes, but he does leave a big impression in this film. And it's funny, like his way, you know, Lisa even brings attention to it where she says, like, why is it that everything you say sounds funny? You know?
Yeah. And like, so ironic.
It's just a gift I have or something. And even when he says that, it's like funny, I know. You know? And I've known people like that just have that kind of weird charisma, like effortless, you know? And growing up especially, it was always frustrating to like see other kids who had that kind of thing, just that ease with like social situations or charming people or whatever.
So
where it just comes like so effortless to him. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's jump back to the beginning and the big scene, you know, where I didn't know anything about this movie. I intentionally kind of went in not wanting to know. And so that bus accident really shook me to the core. And it's one of the most brutal, death scenes I've ever seen in a movie, I think.
It really is. I can't even think of a more impactful, realistic, upsetting, just completely out of the blue, if you don't know it's coming, scene in a film. Like, and I'm glad it's really cool that that you didn't know that, because if you read even like kind of the log line, the one liner description for this movie, a lot of times it's like after a traumatic bus crash, blah blah blah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's really cool that you got to see it cold and just be completely taken by surprise by that, even though it is like super upsetting the way the whole thing unfolds. God. I mean, it feels like that's exactly how it would go in reality.
Yeah, it seems very real. Allison Janney, I think it was brilliant to cast her, because she's someone, like, if you would have cast an unknown, it would have been tough. But I think when you cast an Allison Janney just for that one part, it's someone that everyone loves, I think.
Yeah.
And so it makes it really extra hard to see her slowly and brutally go into the light right in front of your face. It's one of the toughest movie scenes I've ever sat through, man. It was really, really hard to watch.
And it's really gnarly too, the way the blood is, like, they're not shy about like the blood spraying out, and you know, it's really gory. I mean, it's like a war movie, you know, that level of like, and they're talking about the tourniquet and everything, and she's starting to, you know, when we kind of realize that we don't know the full reality of this until later on, where she's asking for her daughter. Her daughter also happens to be named Lisa.
Yeah.
Lisa gets confused by this. She's like, what are you talking about, me? She's like, no, I'm talking about my daughter, Lisa. And then later, you know, later on in the film, we learn that, you know, her daughter Lisa died at 12 and hasn't been around for a long time. That makes it even more kind of upsetting to think about that in the last few minutes of her life. Like, she was confused. She didn't realize that her daughter was really gone. It's just, it's really, really sad. And, I don't know. I mean, the one interesting thing about this film is the particular time in which it's situated, where it's like 4 years after 9/11.
Yeah.
But it's still very much on everybody's mind. It comes up in conversation, you know. I don't think anybody ever like literally says the word 9/11, but they say things like they blew up our city or they killed 3,000 people, things like that.
Yeah.
And in a way, there's something about, I don't know, something about the way this bus crash happens. It brings that to mind, just in the sense that it's this insanely traumatic thing that just comes out of the blue on like a nice, pleasant New York day, you know, and then suddenly like there's this person bleeding and dying in front of you and people are standing around and they're kind of helpless to do anything. And I don't know, it's kind of like a much smaller version of kind of that collective trauma that everybody in that city experienced. I mean, everybody in the country experienced.
Yeah, I think Lonergan said that they were actually shooting during when 9/11 happened.
No, there's no way.
No,
because they didn't, I don't think they started shooting until like 2005, but I think he did have, he's had this script for a long time. I'm pretty
sure.
Maybe
it was when he was writing it.
I think that's what it is. Like he had been working on the script for a long time, and then that happened and he was like, okay, well now this has to be like another layer in the film. And, you know, I think this is like in the canon of great post 9/11 movies, that sort of recreate and truly capture what that moment felt like in the United States. And it's kind of interesting because we're in such a different moment now that there's almost, I think, a kind of collective amnesia a lot of us have when it comes to that period, and just remembering what it was like and the kind of things that people were really concerned with at that time. I would say, you know, along with like Spike Lee's 25th Hour, this is like one of the great movies to respond to that whole period, particularly through the lens of like New York City.
Yeah, and through the lens in this case of the kids in high school, they go to this sort of hippy dippy, liberal, expensive private school, which she's partially on scholarship for. Although, you know, she's certainly not hurting. Her mom's a Broadway, not star, but pretty big actor.
And yeah.
Her dad, we'll get to her dad
right,
later,
yes.
The commercial director out in LA on the beach.
Yeah.
Kenneth Lonergan is so great as an actor. I love it. But the way they handle it in this movie is through the eyes of these high school kids, and notably in the school, and they have these very open, hippy-dippy sort of chat, grievance sessions where one of the threads is this Syrian student.
Right.
And just really going at it with the other kids, like screaming at each other. And Anna Paquin, man, she has so many great scenes where she's just full of rage, not only there, but with the scene with, I think, Emily later, Monica's friend, scenes with her mom, Kenneth Lonergan's wife. I mean, she's doing like Academy Award winning level acting in this movie, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's a shame that nobody really got recognized for this movie. You know,
it's crazy.
Yeah. It's
acting is so good.
Yeah. But yeah, I love all the school scenes, the kind of classroom debates. You know, I went to a public school, but I actually did my senior year. I had a class that was kind of like the classes that she's in all the time. Uh-huh. It was called like political philosophy, I want to say, or maybe yeah. political. I think it was called political theory because they didn't want to put the name philosophy in the title of the class.
Right.
It was taught by this guy who was basically retired, and he just taught this one class just for fun, basically. And he was like a kind of like a former 60s radical. And, you know, we were reading like Marx and Nietzsche and all kinds of stuff that would not really be part of the public school curriculum, let's say. And we did have some really heated debates in class because, I mean, my senior year was 2001 going into 2002. So 9/11 happened when I was a senior in high school. And that was when that class was going on. So we had debates in that class about that, you know, about going into Afghanistan and, the cool thing about him was that he, like I said, he was retired. He was not doing it for the money. He did not care if he got fired or if he got complaints or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was basically like a college class, but in a high school format. And, this movie really captures very well, like, I don't know. It reminds me of just that period in your life where you're beginning, you're a teenager, you're starting to get introduced to all these ideas that are probably unfamiliar to you, and you're kind of expanding your mind a little bit, and you're starting to consider other perspectives, and just the way different people react to it. Some people get really offended. Some people are kind of, if anything, maybe too willing to kind of take that stuff on. Without weighing it and really considering it. It's just a really interesting, I can't think of any other film. I mean, there's been plenty of films made like in schools, but rarely have they focused so much in on the classroom discussions and how combative that can be and the dynamics that exist between the students, both inside the classroom and outside the classroom, and how those play off each other. Just really, really interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, and ostensibly, this is all stuff that could have hit the cutting room floor. This is the stuff to me that makes the movie not a movie about a girl who witnessed an accident and follows up on it, but a movie about a girl's life at that age and her, like I said earlier, her whole life. And this one thing happens in it, but it's just a much more rich film, I think, by leaving all this stuff in and all these other side relationships. I mean, it's a movie where you have a very full subplot that could have left concerning her mother and her new boyfriend.
Yeah.
And Jean Reno, who was fantastic in it.
Yes.
And I think having those two, you know, this is her mom who's also struggling in her relationships and in her place in the world. And whether or not she's received well in this play and her narcissism, and they kind of mirror each other. It's really, really good stuff.
Yeah. I love that because how many movies have we seen where the mother character is just like an auxiliary thing to kind of just serve the plot, drive the story forward, whatever, you know, be either an obstacle or a help when she's needed, but not to be this fully rounded 3D character. And, I love this idea that, like, I mean, the thing that we see over and over and over again in this film is how something very dramatic can be happening, but there's this other thing also happening right at the same time that kind of overlaps it, and people's attention is like pulled in different directions. So she's very worried about this new play that she has opening, but at the same time, her daughter has just had this massive traumatic thing. And even like the day that it happens, she has like a performance or a rehearsal or something that night. And she kind of asked her daughter, like, do you want me to stay home? I can just tell them I'm not coming in tonight. And she says, no, just, it's fine. Just go. I'm going to go to the movies. You know, I don't really want to just sit around here and think about it either. So just go and it'll be fine. Like, she's kind of, Lisa at that point is trying to just kind of like speed past the thing and get beyond it, even though it's weighing on her immediately and she can't really even sit through the movie. And, you know, obviously it's, there's no way that she can just kind of move beyond it. But yeah, the way the mother has to weigh all that stuff together, the way, she's now kind of like dating for what seems like the first time in many, many years, because she's been busy raising her kids and working as a single mom in New York City. So I love that she has this other life and that it's not treated as just like an occasional thing. I mean, it is fully integrated into the story of the movie, even though you could argue if this is really Lisa's story, some of that stuff doesn't need to be there. But then if it wasn't there, it wouldn't be this movie. It wouldn't be Margaret. It wouldn't be saying what really Lonergan is trying to say with this film about, you know, the many different stories in everyone's life and how those all intersect.
Yeah, because so often, like you said, you see the mom character just reacting and either helping or not helping, but you don't know why they might react or help or not help.
Yeah.
In this movie, she's so full. And I mean, you could have made an entire movie about this woman who's a Broadway actor that's getting on up a little bit in years.
Yeah.
And a single mom. It could have been totally from her point of view.
Absolutely.
And then dating this new man who she's, it's a good guy, but she's having such a hard time really connecting with.
Right.
There's that great scene where, you know, she talks about not really even knowing him. And he's kind of like, can we just not do those things? Yeah. And like, here, let's just look at a photo album of my family. And
yeah.
He has a very different idea of what a relationship is. And she is a woman who I feel like is struggling whether or not, like, is that enough?
Right.
Because he's a handsome man, he's French and he's, has money and all these things that would make him a good catch, quote unquote. But she's not satisfied.
No, he's kind of boring, you know.
He is kind of boring.
It's sort of the parallel character, and you can count on me, the boyfriend in that film too.
Yes.
Is the same kind of thing where it's like good guy, reliable, you know, he's gonna provide for the family. He's very family oriented. He's not gonna be a scumbag or anything. Like, he's going to be faithful, all that stuff. But at the same time, he's just not particularly compelling or exciting. He's just kind of a safe, you know, responsible pick, but not like, you know, the kind of movie idea of like a great romance or something.
Yeah. And then he spoils it all with the, what is it called?
The Israel Palestine debate.
What is he called? The Jewish reaction, or what
is
he called?
Yeah. He says that is the Jewish reaction that she kind of just shuts the conversation down and walks away.
Oh, man.
And then he says later on, like, if I had just said the Israeli reaction instead of the Jewish reaction, there wouldn't be this problem. But yeah, the film is really, that's a very, very interesting kind of through line in the film, because there's a lot of talk about Afghanistan, Iraq, and then Israel Palestine comes up in some of the classroom discussions as well. And kind of just, you know, America's relationship to the Middle East and Islam, Judaism, and so on. And just how incredibly, treacherous that territory can be in a conversation like that. And it's Lisa that ends up throwing that bomb into that conversation, you know, because she's just come from the classroom discussion. And now she's like at dinner with the adults and she's like, oh, here's what we had a conversation about in class today. And then it just immediately like, you know, detonates in that conversation. And who knows what would have happened, you know, had she not brought it up, had that not come up, like, he wouldn't have said the thing. Her mom wouldn't have broke up with him.
Maybe
he doesn't have the heart attack then. Who knows? You know, it's just like it's hard to say what the different story might have been.
Yeah, he dies. They go to the funeral, and I don't know if you got the sense, but I feel like every sort of attractive woman they showed felt like an ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, well, like blonde hair a lot of the time.
Is that the implication?
I think so. I think it's yeah. very, very subtle. I didn't pick up on it for a long time. In fact, I think it was somebody's review pointed that out. And then when I watched this, this most recent time, I was like, oh yeah, I do kind of see that. That's like insanely subtle stuff. Cause it's not remarked on at all, but it is kind of the funny thing where like, it's true. It's like if somebody has a type and they actually keep in touch with their exes and so on, then if they did have a funeral, like there might be that moment where everyone kind of looks around and realizes, oh, we all kind of, we all kind of fit the bill, you know, it's kind of a weird thing. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the Kenneth Lonergan's character, the father, the TV commercial director who was out on the West Coast on that, in that sweet pad on the beach.
Yeah.
The only thing we see of their relationship, I think, is it three or four phone calls?
Something like that. Yeah.
I want to say
it is.
Three.
I think it is four, maybe.
Is it four? And he's such a good actor, you know, doing what he does, which is, in this case, sort of this kind of schlubby, woe is me, narcissist father who, you know, he loves his daughter, but he's also kind of like, he's not really listening to her that much, I don't feel like.
Well, it's like he has, I mean, everybody in the movie has like their story that they think they're in, that they think their life is, and the meaning that they think their life has, and the sort of grand purpose that they ascribe to things. And so everybody is interpreting reality through that story, through that lens. And he has his particular lens. And for some reason, maybe because she's like, you know, I think she's what, like a junior or senior in high school.
So, yeah, she's 17.
Right. So, you know, she's right on the cusp of young adulthood. Mm-hmm. And in his mind, the big thing is like a boyfriend. Like, is she going to have a boyfriend? Is she not going to have a boyfriend? What are the boys doing? Who's she seeing? So every conversation becomes about that. And he never gives her the space to be like, to just ask her like, what's going on with you? You know, tell me what's been going on in your life. And it's always like he asked her a specific thing and she can respond to that specific question. And then it's like, she can barely get a word in, you know, and when she finally tells him about the accident, which is quite a long time after it actually happens, when she finally opens up about it, she has to kind of just butt in and say, hey, whoa, wait a minute, Dad, there's actually something kind of serious I need to talk to you about. But it takes her making that extra step to get him to like kind of listen. And then there's that great sequence where, you know, he's heard the story and now he's trying to give his advice a little bit. And then his like new girlfriend or wife comes in.
Yeah.
And again, it's this great thing where, and it's so true to life, where things, you know, in drama that would never happen, right? In drama, you would just have the conversation, father and daughter, without the interruptions, and it would kind of get to the core of something in their relationship. But instead, this other person comes in midway through and they're talking about, what food do you want to order for the trip that we're doing in like
this horse trip?
Yeah. And it's just so funny the way you can see his patience being tested with every additional interruption where he like covers the phone. He's like, I'm sorry, I'm just in the minute. I'm just in the middle of something right now. Can we please just, and he's holding it back and he's holding it back because he's this mild mannered guy, but you kind of get this sense that sooner or later he's going to explode too because of just the stress that he's being put under by being pulled in these two directions at the same time. And I love the kind of almost uncinematicness of that, you know, of having these like inconvenient things happen in the middle of what should be these big pivotal dramatic moments. But that's just how life is. It's not, it's never as smooth as you see in a movie.
Yeah. And that's one of the many moments where it's sort of dabbles in cinema verite a little bit, I think, to great effect. And the other thing I noticed from that scene too, well, a couple of things is he's sort of miserable in his life too. He doesn't like his current wife either.
Right.
And I think he's just kind of a sad bastard generally.
He's probably very self-pitying and, it's so funny. Like, whenever they talk, you know, she's like, how are you? He's like, oh, things are good, I think.
Yeah, it's a little slow.
But I might have some stuff coming up in the fall. And, you know, it's like he's talking to his agent or something. It's like that. But he is this self-obsessed person, which Lisa is too in a way. And everyone is to some extent. But he's never. It's interesting because on one hand, he is maybe a more like well-read, thoughtful, kind of philosophical person. He has that kind of you know, he brings up that great quote about George Bernard Shaw saying that, you know, the Englishman sees the world as their own personal moral gymnasium.
Yeah, because she uses that and didn't right. really. He thought he, she was quoting that.
He knows where it's from.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in some ways he is more reflective and thoughtful, but in other ways he's completely trapped in his own mind, in his own perspective. And he's just kind of not really there as a father, even though he probably thinks he is, because he's right. never done anything nasty. He's never done, you know, any of the things you're quote unquote not supposed to do as a parent. But at the same time, he's kind of he just has her at arm's length emotionally, and they're not really close the way you hope a parent and child would be.
Yeah. And the other thing he does in that scene, which is what all the adults do when they hear this story, and I think it's a big part of the movie, which is the accident and this conundrum she's in from a teenager's point of view.
Right.
And then from the adults, and every single adult that she tells, the first thing they say is, we should call an attorney.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she doesn't get it. She doesn't want to. Emily says it. He says it. I think her mom says it.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is like, oh shit, this could be really bad. And we need to just talk to someone who knows how we should best handle this. Where she is just all id and all emotion and just wants to get this guy fired so he doesn't do this again.
And it's also like she's only looking at it from the perspective of this kind of objective morality, ethical kind of lens.
Yeah.
Because that's what she's kind of getting in all her classrooms. She's getting these great moral debates in the abstract kind of. And so she sees this thing happens in her life, and she almost sees like, oh, this is one of those great conundrums that I can kind of explore, you know? And she doesn't think about, I mean, the first thing that her mom says is that, well, sweetie, like, he probably has a family he has to take care of. There's these real world connections, and you know, the understood assumption is like, It was an accident. It wasn't like he maliciously ran this person over. It was negligent in the moment, but it didn't come out of this great malice. And you also, Lisa, bear some responsibility for this event. So because it's kind of messy and gray, and because no matter what we do, we're not going to bring this person back to life. Like, what is really to be gained by ruining this guy's life for a mistake that like anybody could make? And so that's the response of the adults, is just like, let's think about how this is going to affect this other person, their family, that certainly has no responsibility for this accident, but they would suffer too if he were to lose his job, his pension, and so on. So that's like the lens through which the adults view it, which is like, it's ambiguous, it's gray area, you know, there's shades of right and wrong, it's not so clear. Whereas Lisa is much more of an absolutist, like, you know,
as a child would be.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
you know, because she's so disillusioned in the end by the system, because she thinks it should be very simple. Like, I go in there, I change my statement, and they get this guy fired and make sure he can't do this again. Cause that's how it works. And that's not how the system works. And she just sort of, the system's always there, man. It's always moving.
Yep.
And she just gets sort of swept up into it for a moment.
Yeah.
And she, like, I'd almost like to see a sequel to this movie of Lisa in her 30s or 40s.
To see how she's changed, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, have her have a kid. It's such an interesting character. The naivete of youth is just on such full display here. And the rage and the pure emotion of youth. There's so many scenes where she just explodes, like, on her mom or on Emily in that one scene where, that great, great scene where we were talking about earlier, where she doesn't realize she kind of is making it about her, but she is. But she's also a kid that went through this trauma. And like, she did kind of feel for a moment like she was her kid and that they had this moment. But the best friend didn't want to hear that shit, you know?
No, it's one of those things where it's like, the movie does this so well, where the tension that breaks in that scene is something that's kind of been building, you know, over time. And Emily is kind of like this. She's probably had to bite her tongue a few times before this, but when she starts talking, specifically about, you know, I was with your friend and she was dying. And I think for a few minutes, she confused me with her daughter. And, you know, it's almost like for those few minutes, I was her daughter. It just rubs her the wrong way. Like, hang on, like you're really building yourself up to be like in a movie, you would be sort of like the last thing before, you know, everything flashes to white and we cut to the funeral or whatever. Like you would be like the kind of, the conclusion of this person's life is to be kind of quote unquote reunited with their daughter for a few minutes, you know, before passing on. Whereas Emily has this perspective of much more like, no, it's just a dumb, stupid, unfortunate, tragic thing that happened. And it's almost a disservice to her life to ascribe that particular event too much meaning because it changes everything that came before it. And it's unfair in a way because it's just a dumb accident and it shouldn't affect how we think about the rest of this person's life. So there's no need. And it's almost offensive to like narrativize that event and, and put your cast yourself as like the leading supporting character as this sort of like angel or something that comes in at the 11th hour and like shepherds them into the afterlife. It's just kind of, you know, Emily's grossed out by it and she can't hold her tongue any longer.
Yeah. And I think she's sort of like, I think she clearly gets that from her mom because her mom's a good woman and she's a single mom, like keeping it together, but she's also narcissistic.
Right.
And I think that scene where, that great scene where the mom wants to get together with this new woman in her life that she's pursuing this case with. And she just sort of says, you know, she tells me you're in a play. And then she starts that narcissism of like, oh, well, you know, it's nice to be recognized and then and all this stuff. Yeah. And you can see in Emily's eyes, like, that's where she gets it. Like, like
she's like, I see where this comes from. Yeah.
And these sort of, I mean, they live in the same neighborhood, I guess. But I guess if you get the feeling that maybe Emily is in, not that she's poor, but maybe in some like kind of old school rent control scene and not a part of this Upper West Side Broadway star kind of scene.
Right. She's a little bit more, not working class, but she's definitely like a little bit more. I mean, she seems like a lifelong New Yorker. She has that kind of toughness and terseness in a way.
Totally.
But at the same time, whatever she does, it seems like she would probably be involved in like, you know, literary life or something kind of intellectual in a way. She's not living high on the hog. She doesn't have some glamorous life, but she does have her life that she's carved out for herself in the city. And, it's clear that Lisa and her family come from a little bit of a different strata in that way, as does the Mark Ruffalo, the bus driver.
Yeah. That boy, that scene where she finally goes and confronts him. It's funny before that happened, I thought he was not going to appear again in the movie except
just
for the beginning.
Cameo.
Yeah. Like I had this fan fiction theory that that's Terry from You Can Count on Me.
He's moved like, to New York, got his bus driver's license. Yeah.
Exactly. But then it turned out to be a totally different thing. And
a much less caring, sympathetic character, I guess.
Than Terry. And the great, what is her name? I'm looking now. Rosemary DeWitt, who is just so great in everything that she's in. A very small part here, but that's a really tough scene. Because he just basically denies it flat out. Like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And you can see her. This is when the reality of the system starts to wash over her. Like, the fact that this guy won't admit and confide in her, like, this thing happened between us and that's why I hit her. Like, she's just outraged that this could be how things go in life and how it works in the world.
Exactly. That this great injustice could happen and there's nothing anybody can do about it to change it. And all the adults seem okay with it, you know? No, like there's nobody's going to stand up and make the great speech in the courtroom and like justice is going to be served and everyone's going to learn this great lesson. Like, no, it's just like, because there's this whole backdrop of like, there's a big labor dispute negotiation happening and the transit workers union does not want to fire any of its employees, especially related to like an outside civil complaint, because that's going to show that they are not protecting their workers the way that a union is supposed to. And so, and that's really interesting too, because if you think of just like in the abstract, you think, okay, well, like it's a union, it's going to protect the workers, they're going to get better wages, they're, you know, there's going to be better conditions and so on, there's going to be more job security. It's going to help all these people who are kind of working class to still have like a pretty reliable way of living, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's this good thing in the overall big picture, but in the specific where this like injustice has happened, just the way the power dynamics shake out and everything, they're going to defend this guy who's not a great guy and who probably shouldn't be driving a bus because he's had these other prior complaints and they've just kind of moved him around from place to place and swept it all under the rug. So yeah, you like on the one hand, you do want accountability, but on the other hand, you don't want it to go so far that like they can just fire people at will and you know, pay people less and, you know, race to the bottom kind of stuff. So again, it's that moral complexity, like the injustice done to this one small person versus the greater kind of good of having these labor protections and so on, and the way that there are contradictions involved all the time.
Yeah. And it's just reality smashing her in the face like over and over again in this movie. The scene with that fucking asshole detective who is not sitting in for the other, but the other guy's not there yet,
right?
And boy, the way she's treated by this guy, and it's just, that didn't have to be in this movie, but I feel like that was sort of one of the points, is like, this is the adult world, and you are a 17-year-old coming in there acting like you should get this special attention or maybe any attention. And she's dismissed at every turn. And that guy's such a fucking jerk.
Yeah, he's a huge jerk. And you also get the sense that, like, in a way, it's just pure happenstance that she got the detective that she got, who is a more sympathetic ear and is actually willing to kind of humor her a little bit.
Yeah.
More, much, much more than this other jaded kind of jerk is going to. He's willing to hear her out. He actually is willing to amend the statement and talk to the bus driver again. And he's only going to take it so far, but he's at least willing to take it that far, whereas this other guy just completely shuts her down. He's very condescending, calls her honey. And just, you know, she tells him her name like 3 seconds later. He's like, what's your name again? Okay, Lisa, blah, blah, blah. You know, he's like just a real prick, but very, very realistically portrayed, you know, and we've all met those people too.
So Matt Damon is in this movie. He plays her sort of young and handsome teacher. And like I said earlier, you could have completely made a movie just about what happens with them.
Right.
There are movies that exist that are just about that.
Yep.
And it was so realistic. And so, and I imagine this is one of the things that could have been cut whole cloth from the movie in a shorter version. But it's like all this is going on. And then she's sort of throwing herself at these different boys.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't know what the hell to do. I think part of it is just that sort of thing you do when you're going through a trauma to distract yourself. But this one was really tough to watch when she goes to his apartment and you're just like,
don't do it.
And she's so, what's the word? Like that young siren, man. That's like, she's using all of her young feminine wiles, which she doesn't even fully understand how powerful that is.
Yeah.
And, and he does. And she gets pregnant and it's fucking just brutal.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. Like in terms of the things, some of the things that were cut for the shorter version, the scene where she actually goes and gets the abortion is not in the shorter cut.
Oh,
so you do see the fact that they had sex. That's still in there. And then the scene later on where she walks up to Matt Damon and the other teacher on the street and just says, just blurts out, Did you guys know I had an abortion last week?
God, that was so
Don't see the actual abortion in the middle. So in the shorter cut, it actually plays like, is Lisa telling the truth? Is she messing around? Is she just playing a head game with this guy? It's a very different tone that it takes by removing that one scene. Yeah. Yeah. You don't know. Like you're just kind of left to like, maybe she was, maybe she wasn't. We're not really sure if that's just something she's saying to kind of see what his reaction is going to be like, if he's going to, you know, who knows? So yeah, it makes her into a somewhat different character. It's a little more diabolical. The idea that she might just be throwing that out there to like scare him or kind of, mess with his head a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, he should, and this is someone who, was going to be a teacher at one point. My parents were both teachers. Like, you don't even go get the coffee with her.
Right. Yeah.
You don't invite her to your apartment. Like, I feel like he might have had decent intentions initially because she was a one of his students that was kind of suffering
right.
and reaching out to him. But like, you just, you can't. And he tries early on, you know, to not put himself in that position, but he does. And then,
yeah, that scene, you know, where she kind of sees him riding his bike and you know, she starts to say all this stuff like, did you know I'm like insanely in love with you? And I'm not a virgin if you're worried about that, you know, and he's just like, I can't be having this conversation, gets on his bike and gets out of there. But
that should have been the end of it.
But I feel like, I mean, the big mistake was certainly he crossed the line in having her over to his apartment like that. And then there's almost like a secondary line crossing in the scene where she asks if she can smoke in the apartment. He says, yeah, sure. And he goes up to get an ashtray.
Yeah.
And then when she sits back down, she sits next to him. And then it's kind of all over from there. But and I love
because
that,
she moves over next to him.
Yeah. She's
before, you know, she was in a different chair.
Exactly. Yeah. They're, he's on a couch. She's in a chair. And then after, you know, he gets up to get the ashtray and she goes up to get a light. They sit back down on the same couch side by side. And then she starts moving in and it goes pretty quickly from there, even though he's still kind of like, we can't, we shouldn't, don't, you know, he gives in pretty quickly.
Yeah. Another scene that could have easily been cut and a character that could have been cut was Matthew Broderick's character and the great the Shakespeare scene.
Oh, it's so funny. Yeah.
In class. It's so funny. And it doesn't even add much to the film other than just a bit of comic relief of this teacher. And in my mind, it was also a little bit of fan fiction that even though I think they, or oh no, I guess it could have worked out timeline wise that was the teacher from Election.
Right. He's also relocated like Mark Ruffalo. They've both gone to.
Yeah. Because he went to New York. So maybe he gets this job where he ends up.
He lands on his feet.
Fighting with this this little young male version of Tracy Flick what Shakespeare means. And it's that thing that we probably saw in school, but maybe didn't even recognize because we were just kids.
Well, there's something funny in that scene where he basically just like the kid keeps coming back to him with this interpretation like, well, like, you know, Shakespeare's comparing, you know, humans to flies and gods to humans. And you know, like if he keeps talking about like, if gods have a higher consciousness, then they don't think the way humans think and the way that, you know, a fly cannot understand the way a human thinks. And so what we perceive as, you know, a malicious act on the part of the gods, you know, killing us for their sport. Maybe there is some grand design and we just can't appreciate it because we're these mere humans and they're these great gods that have this higher consciousness. Which I think is, I mean, it's a fine interpretation, but it's just funny because you can tell Matthew Broderick is like, well, that's not the scholarly opinion on this passage. You know, all the literary critics agree Shakespeare is talking about this other thing. And that's ultimately the only rebuttal he has. Like he doesn't really have, he kind of has this offhanded remark like, well, you know, Shakespeare says somewhere else in the play that that's not what he's talking about, but I don't even want to get into that. Like he kind of just like Bigfoots him and is just sort of like, look, here's what the established scholarly opinion says this passage means. That's what it means. You're wrong. We're moving on, you know? And it's funny because all throughout the scene, he like keeps drinking this orange juice. After he has that final blow up, he like walks over to his desk and like eats a sandwich. So you kind of get the idea that like, maybe he's just like hungry and he's a little cranky and that's why he's being particularly short with his student today. There's so many things like that throughout the film where someone who's maybe even in a position of authority, like a grown up that you think is supposed to be this kind of like evolved, neutral, kind of moral authority. They have all these like mitigating circumstances. So maybe Matthew Broderick is just hungry and cranky. Maybe something's going on in his life and he's not in the best mood. So on a different day, maybe he would have engaged more with that student's ideas and they could have had like a fruitful discussion. Instead, he just like shuts him down. He's like, look, we're moving on. That's not what we're talking about here. Cause that's not, I'm not equipped to discuss this in the way that you're bringing forward because I have this like preconceived notion of what the scene's about. And so we're just going to move on. That's kind of what he does to the kid.
Yeah. My take on that scene was that Matthew Broderick wasn't following him and didn't really understand him. And the kid kind of outwitted him And he did the opposite of what a teacher should do, which was, I'm caught not fully understanding it, because eventually he does kind of say, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
But what you should do as a teacher is indulge it, right, and ask for more explanation and say, you know what? You kind of got me here. I really don't know what you're saying, but let's talk more about it. But he's, I think the ego, there's narcissism from the adults on display all throughout this movie.
Yes.
Very sort of subtly. And I think this is just another example of that adult ego with a kid around not wanting to sort of reveal his hand, which is, I don't really know what this kid's talking about right now.
Yeah. He wants to maintain that air of like knowing it all.
Authority.
Of authority. Yeah. And of being like, I'm the teacher, you're the student, I'm going to tell you what this stuff means. Even when I ask you what you think it means, I want you to tell me the thing that I already think it is. And if you come at me with some other idea that doesn't connect up with like what I had in mind to discuss or the way I see it, instead of like engaging with that, he just shuts it down. Which is, I've seen that happen, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of times also, like there's that one kid who always, like when he's called on, he has like a dumb thing to say kind of. Uh-huh. So I've been in classrooms where that happens too. We all have, where it's like, you're having a really cool discussion about something and then someone just throws a wrench into it because they're not really following the train of thought that everyone else is. And they kind of derail it over where, you know, that the one that's coming to mind right now is the kid who says, you know, why is it cool to bomb men, but like, it's not cool to bomb women and children. Like, isn't that just like reverse sexism or something?
Right.
And the teacher's like, I don't know. Like, you know, that's not really the conversation we're having. And you're sort of like, your premise is way off and I don't really want to get into this. Like they just kind of hand wave it.
God bless the teachers.
Yeah.
So let's talk some about the filmmaking. This is a movie that has some of the most beautiful transition shots that I've ever seen in a movie.
And it was a real love letter to the city and
big time. Know, it was clear to Lonergan that Lonergan really wanted to showcase New York. A bunch of them spring to mind, but I've jotted down a few of my favorites. That one transition where he usually has that lockdown shot from above on the city street. Right. And I think that probably might be outside her apartment maybe, mm-hmm. but the one where he finally moves the camera and it tilts slowly all the way up the endless avenue at night.
Yeah.
And then it follows that plane.
Yeah.
As it flies through the sky to its conclusion.
As it like, kind of goes along the edge of that building. Like it never got overlapped by the building. It was like a crazy shot. I don't know how they got that or how they planned it or if it was just sheer luck or what, but I mean, the time to kind of scout like the flight paths and just knowing that like a plane's going to fly over that and timing it and, you know, getting the shot where it's like smooth and everything. Very, very impressive kind of a technical achievement there.
Yeah. And so many shots like this, all the transition shots, these languid, slow tilts and pans around New York City. The shots of the buildings reflecting in other buildings.
Yeah.
Just a real love letter. The one shot, God, that I loved was toward the end when they're at the opera and it follows her all the way down the staircase.
Yeah.
And then through the door into the theater, all the way to her seat. And it's just like this one continuous shot. It's just fucking gorgeous.
Yeah. And it's not a showy film, I don't think. I mean, every time he does that, there's like a real kind of narrative purpose that he's serving. It's not showy in that way. But at the same time, it is very ambitious formally, in a way I think that's really, really cool. And very, very interesting. There's another one of those great panning shots of the city skyline that I think is really cool where they're panning and it's kind of tracking along with like this bird that's flying in the sky, but then it continues to pan. And there's also like an airplane in the background and then it continues to pan and, you know, just these really, really nice, visual moments that again, like you could not stage, you just have to be there with a camera and look for it, wait for it and catch something interesting like that.
Very really, Malick really cool. Like.
Yeah. There's that shot in Tree of Life where you see like the flock of birds like changing direction spontaneously. And,
yeah.
It kind of reminded me of that shot a little bit.
Another one. And I think all the airplanes, there are a lot of shot of airplanes. I think that was sort of a little nod to 9/11 too.
Sure. Yeah. And just the idea too, that like when you look up at an airplane, you're looking up at potentially hundreds of people again, all with their own story. Maybe they're coming to New York. Maybe New York is just a connection. But like the sense that everyone's life is just like moving, you know, there's always movement. There's always things going on. There's like way too many things to contain. There's just like this constant flood of things happening all around, you know, and, all we can do is try to contain that and contextualize it for our own lives. But,
yeah,
you know, cause you would kind of like lose your mind if you tried to actually literally respond to all the stimuli. There's no way. You have to filter it down.
I miss New York. Another couple of shots that I loved. One, that great, great shot from behind where Lisa's walking down the sidewalk.
Yeah.
And the camera is following, the lens is following her
right.
as she walks. And then at a certain point, and I've never seen a shot do this. It stops. The camera stops. It's not a push. It's actually a zoom, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then it starts to widen back out.
Yeah.
And then it tilts up and follows into the sky.
Down. Yeah.
It was unbelievable. And if you looked at it on paper, it's a very showy shot.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really come across that way in this movie somehow.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably, you know, when Lonergan's talking about this idea of like having shots where you just kind of happen to catch Lisa in a crowd, but it's not really framed for her.
Yeah.
That one does definitely start out on her because it's kind of a long lens. It's a little bit of shallow depth of field with the focus on her, and the focus is tracking with her as she walks into the crowd. But at a certain point, the focus stops and it just kind of sits and you start to see other people come into focus as she gets mm-hmm. completely, you know, absorbed by this crowd. Like they start overlapping her and then you just lose sight of her.
Yeah.
Then it starts to kind of, the zoom starts pulling back and tilting up. And yeah, it's one of those things where like, You very rarely see camera moves like that in a film where there's not some kind of foreground subject that you're tracking with that kind of motivates the camera to move that way. It is a very like almost fourth wall kind of breaking shot where it's just like,
it is.
We're gonna do this thing that's a very, very overt camera move. And I'm just going to kind of show my hand a little bit in terms of, I want you to be taking in this broader perspective of all these people in this city. And again, just to kind of illustrate that idea, this film could be about any one of these people in this whole crowd. And it would kind of be saying at a fundamental level, the same thing, that everyone has these lives that are going on.
So the final shot that I want to talk about is the great sort of subtle shot where she goes down and gets on the subway under the poster, her Broadway poster of her mom.
Controversy.
And doesn't even acknowledge it. She's like literally walks right by the poster of her mom's face and doesn't even fucking look at it.
Yeah.
Very, very nice little moment, I think, from Lonergan there.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the way that it's just like, it's part of the landscape. It's part of the backdrop. But, you know, I mean, that seems realistic, right? That if all your life your mom's been in plays like that, then it's nothing special to you particularly anymore.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a teenager and you're kind of self-involved and, you know, you don't have a more evolved perspective where you're like, you know what, that's really cool that my mom's an actress and, you know, so on.
She's just kind of like that,
annoyed by it probably.
Yeah. You get the feeling that later in life she would appreciate it more.
For sure. Yeah.
And there are times when she is, you know, when you can tell she's not super annoyed by it, but she's a teenager.
She has that scene where, you know, it's a really, really great argument scene, mother-daughter kind of argument, where her mom is like getting ready to go out on a date. She asked Lisa, you know, does this dress make me look fat? And Lisa's like, yeah, a little. And then she's like, well, there's nothing what more I can dick. Do about it now. And then, you know, the whole thing about like, do you want to go to the opera in a few weeks? And Lisa's like, no, I don't like opera. And then they kind of have a back and forth about that. And like, you know, her mom eventually says to her, like, why does everything I say to you like annoy you so much?
Yeah.
And then Lisa has that kind of meltdown where she's like, mom, I don't care about this. I don't care about your dumb problems or my dumb problems. You know, there's bigger things out there.
Scene.
And, I just like, I really can remember similar moments when I was like a teenager and you have those weird, like hormonal kind of shifts that happen where suddenly you're just in a terrible mood or something. And, it's like, you start to like butt heads with your parents for really no reason. You know, you're like, there's a phase that some kids get into where they're just kind of annoyed by almost the existence of their parents. I don't know. Like, I love the way that, in that scene, like her mom, like, you know, calls her the C word and then she throws it back at her and she's like, all right, well, let's not start calling names. It's like, you just call me that. Like, It's really, really funny. And and then like, you know, all of this is leading up to she's supposed to meet Jean Reno that night. And then, you know, she's like, well, should I have him come up or should I just have him wait downstairs? You know,
it's I
like
know. That, she's that, so that kind weird of clueless still.
she just wants to, you know, introduce her kid. And now like this meltdown has happened. And even when they like start going on their date and they're kind of walking up to Lincoln Center, there's, you know, she has this kind of like worried, unhappy look on her face. And he asks her, is everything all right? And she kind of like switches it off. She's like, no, everything's fine. And, you know, I love that. The way that you could say, I mean, in most movies, if you had a date scene like that, it would just all be about, you know, one person anticipating the date, the other person anticipating the date and the nervousness and so on. And then like whatever happened between them emotionally, it would all just be about the two of them. You wouldn't introduce this third element, which is her daughter happened to pick a fight like five minutes before she's about to walk out the door. And there's that great scene in the elevator too, where she gets on the elevator, her mom does, and she's kind of crying. And then the elevator stops on another floor and like a neighbor gets on and she very quickly has to kind of collect herself. And then the neighbor happens to know that she's an actor and, you know, starts complimenting her and everything. And she has to be kind of gracious in that moment. But I love the way that all these things are constantly colliding with each other again, like in a way that you almost never see in drama or fiction.
Yeah. Let's talk about that last scene, you know, and I kind of called it to myself because I watched it by myself last night earlier when she does invite her to the opera. Immediately when she said she'd go, I went, that's going to be the last scene.
Right. That's going to be it. Yeah.
I could kind of see that coming. And, you know, they get dressed up and she even has that sweet line the mom does where she goes, we can dress up, like, you know, that connection she's trying to make, girls' night out kind of thing. And, boy, and you know, just throughout the movie, his use of classical music and opera is just outstanding. And it comes to its apex here where this very moving thing is happening on stage. Everything is finally just culminated
in
his life to the point where she starts breaking down. The mom looks over and starts breaking down. And then they're just sitting there bawling and just have this embrace that's like so healing for the audience member to see this happen.
There's that great so overhead looking down shot where she reaches her hand over and, you know, again, she's kind of gripping because she's like holding on for dear life because she's, you get the sense that this is the moment, whatever, you know, this catharsis has arrived because of the beautiful music, because she's there with her mom in the opera and, you know, so many things are going on and the case has just been settled in this really unsatisfactory way, this really unjust way. She's even just seen the bus driver like out again. And it's like, in this one moment, she just kind of like has this breakdown and, you know, she's holding on for dear life and she grabs onto her mom and they start holding each other. And this is beautiful moment of like reconciliation and healing and connection. And, you know, you get the sense that this is like, it is a breakthrough. It's maybe not the last breakthrough she's going to have, but this is a big one to kind of reestablish that, that relationship she has with her mother. And, and just kind of return to the fundamentals. Like she can leave that parallel life she's been living with like the court case and just everything that's been going through her mind about the bus accident. She can start to kind of put that behind her now and focus on what's going to be next in her life because the rest of the world has moved on and she's certainly done all she could do to try to rectify that. The system has kind of neutered the response, but she did what she could do. And now it's time to get on with her life.
Yeah. And I mean, just that's one of the things. It's also losing her virginity and sleeping with her teacher and getting pregnant and having an abortion and having this fraught relationship with this new woman who Emily, who sort of plays out as a little surrogate mom in subtle ways. And then this brutal situation that she goes through with this cousin in Arizona who are just money grubbers. And again, all these reality checks slapping her in the face of like, this is what the adult world is like. You're going to the private school and on the Upper West Side. And like, this is what the real world is. Punch, punch, punch.
I love the line that the lawyer has where he's like, this is how our society punishes people. You sue not the individual, but the insurance company of the employer.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so abstract. It seems to have nothing to do with any form of justice. She wanted a
personal payback. Yeah.
She wanted, you know, it's like when they're on that final speakerphone conversation, she's like, I know I did it. I know I'm responsible. I just want somebody, you know, I want him to know that he was responsible too. I want somebody to acknowledge that, you know, that something wrong happened here. It can't just, how can it be that something like that can happen and the world just keeps moving and nothing changes? Yeah. It just seems so unjust and unfair because she's had this idea that in the world, you know, the bad people are punished and the good people are rewarded. And, you know, it's just not that simple.
I get and that's sort of a 9/11 allegory as well. I sort of get the feeling that if she had gone to Mark Ruffalo in that scene and he asks his wife for some time alone and he breaks down and says, I'm so sorry. I've been hoping you would come by. I can barely sleep at night. I can't believe this happened. And I've had a family. Thank you for lying because I can't lose my job. Like that would have been enough for her.
Exactly.
I think.
Yeah. That's all she really wanted was just, you know, that private admission between the two of them that, you know, there's nothing we can do to bring her back now, but can we at least admit among ourselves in private that this is what happened and that we're both responsible? And he was just like, you know, his only response really is to just completely shut it down and play innocent. Like, I have no idea what you're even talking about. What I was looking at you, what do you mean? And then he finally has this thing where he's like, look, like the brakes on the bus can only slow down at a certain rate and the distance between me and there. So you can tell he's had this rationalization. Exactly. Yeah. That's the story he's told himself in his mind, which is a very like technical one of like, you know, brake responsiveness and this is the distance from the intersection and all that kind of stuff. He's like, no, it's a physics problem. Like there's nothing that could have been done. You know? That's how he's justified it to himself. And it's just, it's very interesting that whole sequence, you know, if you really think about it in retrospect, if any one of those elements had been different, it might not have happened. You know, if for instance, the trip that she was going on was not a horse riding trip, she wouldn't have been looking for a cowboy hat. It never would have happened, you know, if her father had picked some other destination. If Mark Ruffalo hadn't put on the cowboy hat that day, you know, it would have been
sliding
different. Exactly. It's a sliding door thing. Like if Lisa had maybe gotten to the bus a few seconds earlier, maybe he wouldn't have closed the door and they could have had a conversation like on the bus or whatever, you know, like there's so many different things. And there's even, I think, kind of a deep subtext a little bit, which is that he is kind of having this flirtatious moment with her. And he's sort of like, oh, there's like this cute girl and she's chasing the bus. So I'm kind of giving her a hard time. And, then when she goes to see him at home, like the wife is just like immediately super suspicious and you get the feeling that he's probably had some like affairs or something in the past that has driven a real wedge between them in that relationship. And so then when Lisa shows up out of the blue, the wife is already like, who the hell is this person? What is she doing here? You know, what have you gotten yourself
into? Radar's up.
And he's doubly panicked because on the one hand, he's like, you're going to mess up my relationship. She's going to think I'm having some kind of affair with this young woman. And then of course, at the same time, he's also worried about his job and all that. So he's super freaked out.
Did you recognize that attorney, by the way?
He looks super familiar, but I couldn't place like what else I know him from.
He is the Baron Klaus von Espy.
Ah, okay.
From Intolerable Cruelty.
Yeah.
Remember that guy, the Baron Klaus von Espy?
Great, just a great face, you know?
Yeah.
There's so many like...
I immediately saw him. I was like, oh my God, because that's one of my favorite parts of that movie.
There's so many wonderful kind of character actors and familiar faces in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. His part's great. I love just his like... I mean, he inhabits that role so well where he's like, yes, this is our system. Isn't it great that we get money? Like, you know, he has a sense of humor about it because he's a grown up and he knows this is the system. And I'm sure at some point he was also shocked that it was kind of like that callous or whatever. But he's like, look, this is the world as it is. Like, it's the world that exists, not some world of ideals, not some world of quote unquote the way it should be, just reality the way it is.
Such good stuff, man. Good talk. Great movie. God damn. If you haven't seen Margaret, do yourself a favor and watch the 3-hour and 6-minute version. Settle in. It's very rewarding. It is very languid and has a pace that you have to be ready for, but it's just so great, man. Such a good, you know, slice of life and a whole picture of a young woman and a grown woman and her mother, and all these characters are so fully realized. And again, I think that you could have made a hour and 40 minute version of this movie that was great.
Sure.
That was just about this accident. But you strip all that stuff away and it's a different film, you know.
You would essentially not learn or come to this insight that the film is trying to lead you to about how we all invent this story for our own lives, but the whole the world itself is so much larger and more complex than any one person's story. You would lose all that. You would effectively make the same mistake that Lisa makes, you know, if you were to cut this film down. You would be back in that world of like solipsism and narcissism and only dealing with things as they affect you personally, but not thinking about the broader, you know, consequences of actions.
We're all just gnats, Casey.
There's, you know, the poem, because a lot of people get confused and they think that Lisa's name is going to be Margaret, or maybe that the woman who dies is going to be named Margaret, and you're kind of worried
that's a very
daughter.
Sly thing he does.
Yeah. And so this poem, you know, the way it goes by in the film, I think it's hard if you haven't seen the film already to really grasp like what the usage of that poem is.
Yeah.
And it took spring me several fall. Times. Yeah. Oh. Spring and Fall by Gerard Manley Hopkins. It's really interesting. I looked it up on the internet. There's a dedication, like a subtitle to the title kind of, that's not mentioned in the film, but it's dedicated to a young child. So in a way, it's about, you know, the moral and kind of emotional development of a young child that early on in life cries easily and cries at things because it's the first time they've encountered this idea of loss or tragedy or injustice, and how as you age, we become a little bit more coarsened to that stuff. And he says, you know, Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove on leaving? Then the last line, it is the blight man was born for. It is Margaret you mourn for. So you're mourning for yourself. When you see this external tragedy, there's a part of you that feels bad for that person. But at a deeper level, it's the understanding that you too are mortal, right? And that all this stuff that is unfair and is visited upon others, it means that you too could be, you know, could find yourself on the other end of that. Like the speech Emily made, you know, where she says, you know, you're not the one who got hit by a bus and you're not the one who just died in an earthquake somewhere else in the world, you know, but you will be, you know, that's the thing. Yeah. You will be that one day. So I think it's a profound kind of film about, somebody coming to terms with, what it is to be an adult, what it is to be confronted with moral complexity in the world and just a lot of gray area and no easy answers.
Yeah, totally. Great movie. I guess we have Manchester by the Sea next.
That's right. Yeah.
So let's get you in here another month or month and a half.
Sure.
For that laugh fest.
Yeah, that's
I don't know what that's about either. I just know it's tough.
Yeah, don't read anything about it. Go in as cold as you can. And
I'd
love to, you know, look forward to talking about it.
Awesome. And maybe we'll get Kenneth Lonergan on the show one day. I'm gonna see if we can alert him somehow that we've been paying him homage here.
That would be amazing. that would be incredible. Cool. Yeah.
You would be invited, Casey, if you did.
Oh,
I would not
be
able
to exclude
you from that.
All right. I'll just start. I'll try to calm down.
No, I don't think it's going to happen. So don't get too excited.
No, it's a long shot, but we'll see.
All right, man. Well, thanks a lot. Take care. And thank you all for listening. And we will see you next week.
Bye, everybody.
Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.